may it please the court, Robert Borquez, registration number 19577, representing the defendant appellant, Ryan Krueger. Your honors, the defendant is appealing from the judgment of conviction entered on jury verdicts in which he was found guilty of first degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder in El Paso District Court. And although we've got seven issues in our opening brief, I want to focus this afternoon on the first three of those. And obviously, if there are any questions by the panel on the other issues, I'd be happy to attempt to answer those. Otherwise, we would rely on what's in our briefs. We're not abandoning the other issues by any means, but we would just rely on what we put in the brief. I want to get right into the arguments because I am aware of the fact that the panel is familiar. You've read the briefs and you're familiar with the facts in the case. But the first issue that we raised in the brief has to do with the trial court denying Mr. Krueger's requests for appointment of substitute counsel in place of the public defenders who were assigned to his case. And it's our position that the trial court erred in doing that, in denying that request, because the defendant was justified in bringing the issue to the court's attention and requesting appointment of alternate defense counsel because of the public defender's adamant refusal to share the discovery materials with my client. The defendant, as the court knows, took the extraordinary step of going to trial twice in this case on a pro se basis, and I call it extraordinary because he was facing a class one felony. He was facing a potential sentence of life without parole in prison. And it came out very early in this case that Mr. Krueger had a dysfunctional relationship with the public defenders in the case. I think that it's spelled out in our brief and in the people's answer brief that there were four conflict hearings held. One was in July of 2006. The next one, I think, was October of 2006. And there was one the end of January 2007. And the last one was July 2007. And in each of those, the issue of the refusal to share the discovery with Mr. Krueger was brought up. And I want to make real clear one thing that is not an issue, and that is Mr. Krueger was not asking the public defenders to send or leave the discovery materials with him in the jail. Every time this issue came up, the public defenders would respond by saying, well, it's our office policy that we can't leave the discovery with an incarcerated defendant. That was never requested. What Mr. Krueger was requesting was, and because of the volume of discovery, it wouldn't have been very effective or efficient for the public defenders themselves to come out and sit there with him. But he was requesting that they send like a law student intern or a paralegal or a law clerk out there while he looked at the materials. And that would have saved the public defender's office the cost of sending an attorney out there, and it would have given the defendant the opportunity to look at the materials. This is an important issue, Your Honors, because the defendant has only limited decision-making in a criminal case. There's only four real decisions that a defendant gets to make, and that is what plea to enter, whether there's going to be a trial to the court or to a jury, whether to testify, and whether to take an appeal. However, in order for the defendant to intelligently make those decisions, it's our position that the defendant has to be given the opportunity to look at the discovery in a case. There's also another factor involved here, and that is, in order for the public defenders to effectively represent their client, it's our position that the client should be given the opportunity to look at this material, the discovery material, in order for the defendant to then identify for his attorney what issues he's taking, what issues are in dispute. In other words, by allowing the defendant to look at the discovery material, it enhances defense counsel's ability to effectively represent the defendant. There's no real Colorado case law on that issue, on the issue of whether the defendant has a right to discovery. But it's our position that in order to give effect to the rights that the defendant, those issues on which the defendant has the right to make decisions, that being able to view the discovery is imperative.
Mr. Borquist, the defendant could allege that he did not receive page 301 of 301 pages of discovery. Would it be your position that he's got a legitimate claim that his public defender improperly represented him?
I think it would depend on what was on page 301, Your Honor.
So what was there, do we know, what was there in the discovery that he wasn't shown, that once he went pro se, he said, aha, this is important, this is what I wasn't shown, and now I'm going to do something with it?
Well, the harm that came from not sharing the discovery, Your Honor, wasn't that some particular document was withheld from him, because once the public defenders withdrew and he went pro se, he obviously had access to everything. But the harm that befell Mr. Krueger was, because the discovery was withheld, he had a lack of confidence in his attorneys. There was a breakdown in the relationship. That's where the harm was, and he was forced to go to trial pro se. But it wasn't this specific page of discovery was withheld. Okay. If there are no other questions on that particular issue, I was going to move on to the issue of whether Curtis should apply to a motions hearing. That's our next issue, Your Honors, and that is the question of who gets to make the decision as to whether the defendant testifies at an evidentiary pretrial hearing, the defendant or defense counsel. And you know, Curtis, the language in Curtis is fairly broad. However, it doesn't limit its holding to trials alone. Now, there's nothing in there that says this also applies to motions hearing. And I think that's going to be part of the people's argument. The only authority we were able to find from other states were the cases in Florida and the state of Washington. And I understand the people have taken the position that the Washington rule is codified in the rules of criminal procedure and therefore shouldn't really be given much weight. But we beg to differ on that, because we think that just because it's in the rules of criminal procedure and it wasn't judicially crafted doesn't make it any less a matter of judicial policy.
Counsel, the court noted a violation of the rule, but expressly said that did not constitute a constitutional violation. And you're arguing a constitutional right here.
We are, and we are arguing beyond what Washington, the court in Washington, said. But we also have the Florida case as well that we cited in our brief. And admittedly, this is an open question in Colorado. And we are asking this panel here to essentially clarify whether Curtis applies to an evidentiary hearing prior to trial.
So in your view, this wouldn't apply simply to suppression hearings. It would apply to pretrial hearings?
Like a preliminary hearing?
Like a preliminary hearing, yeah. Yeah, that's an evidentiary hearing.
It is an evidentiary hearing, Your Honor, and I'm not looking at it in that context, although I can see somebody making that argument. I'm interested in just arguing the case that I'm here on, which is it was a suppression hearing, and the issue was it involved suppressing statements. And there were questions as to what happened when this police officer came out to my client's home on that Saturday morning. And I think it was Detective Derek Graham testified as to what his recollection was. And Mr. Krueger's position was, no, that's not what happened. And Mr. Krueger wanted to testify as to what his recollection was. And I think what's significant here, Your Honors, is we're dealing with a mixed question of fact and law. If this were purely a legal question, there would be no need for witness testimony, first of all. But the people would be correct. If we're talking about a pure question of law, there's no need for evidence. But here there were factual findings that the trial court was going to have to make based on the totality of the circumstances. I'm not saying it's necessarily a smart idea for a defendant to testify at a pretrial hearing, but the question is, who gets to make that call?
And does the defendant have the right to insist that a suppression hearing be held? Or is that counsel's call?
I think the decision to file a motion per se is counsel's call. That's a strategic decision. However, I think if there is, once the decision is made to file that motion, it raises factual questions. And then you've got Officer Graham or Detective Graham testifying as to what his recollection of the facts were. And that creates a factual issue. And then it becomes a question of whether the defendant is going to be allowed to testify to his recollection. But I think the decision whether to file a particular motion is a strategic decision, if that answers your question.
That's a strategic decision. Why isn't it a strategic decision to be made by counsel whether or not defendant's testimony would be helpful in that motion hearing and, on the other hand, might be terribly harmful to the defendant?
Again, Your Honor, I'm not saying it's necessarily a smart decision by a defendant, but it's our position, it's the defendant's call, because once the decision is made to file that motion, if there are factual issues raised, it becomes a question of, it becomes the defendant's decision whether he's going to, you know, tell his account of what happened or not. I would also add that if there is a legitimate issue which warrants the filing of that motion, I think it's incumbent upon counsel to file that motion. Otherwise, the attorney may be running the risk of an ineffective assistance claim later on. In other words, if there's a valid suppression issue, I think counsel is going to file that motion. If there are no other questions on that particular issue, wanted to move on to the next issue, which has to do with comments made by the deputy district attorney during voir dire and during opening statement about one of the other participants. There were three defendants in this case: Christopher Allen, Benjamin Gunvalson, and my client. And Mr. Gunvalson, of course, entered into a plea agreement with the prosecution, testified against Mr. Allen and Mr. Krueger at their trials. Mr. Allen asserted his Fifth Amendment right, and the prosecution knew that that was coming. And during voir dire, she made references to her inability. She didn't use the term Fifth Amendment, and she didn't use the phrase privilege against self-incrimination. But she did make reference to her inability to compel a participant in the case to testify. And what this did was it triggered an exchange with the veneer panel. And what was really troubling were some of the remarks that went back and forth between the prosecutor and the veneer panel. I'm pointing to the person who was identified as juror number five, who characterized what the prosecutor was talking about, the inability to compel a participant to testify. Juror number five characterized this as the law is weird. There are tons of things that make absolutely no sense. It defies common sense and reasonable thinking. We think that's how they characterize the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. And for a layperson, that's understandable. But then for the deputy district attorney to jump in and endorse that thinking is extremely troubling. The prosecutor described it as awesome, a great explanation, and basically encouraged this way of thinking. It's our position, Your Honors, that the prosecutor didn't have to use the word, the term privilege against self-incrimination or Fifth Amendment in order to be drawing the jurors' attentions, to that issue. If there are no questions on that, I'd like to reserve my minute and a half. Any questions? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Katherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. With regard to the right to counsel, the defendant is essentially saying that he was denied his right to counsel. And in Bergeron, this court, or the Supreme Court, acknowledged that essentially when a defendant is forced to forego, improperly forced to forego his trial rights in order to obtain the right to counsel, that constitutes basically an invalid, non-voluntary waiver of the right to counsel when the defendant ultimately chooses to go pro se. So what we're looking at here is the question of, was the defendant required to forego his right to counsel to preserve other important trial rights. And he has set forth those two trial rights being the right to review discovery personally, all of the discovery, and the right to testify at the suppression hearing. And so basically, first I'd like to point out, this doesn't even satisfy the threshold inquiry in Bergeron. These are not trial rights. These are pretrial procedural parts of a criminal case. They're not trial rights, as was in Bergeron, the right to testify at trial and the right to decide whether to enter a plea of guilty or not. And so we don't even get past that first threshold. But if we do, and we look at whether the defendant was entitled to these things, whether they were in fact rights that he was entitled to, I don't think that there's certainly not well established. There's no case law on the issue of whether the defendant has a right to review all of discovery materials personally. There's no case law on whether the defendant has a right to testify at a suppression hearing. Certainly, at this point, the defendant couldn't raise a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel based on the pure denial of those rights, because there is no such established right. So he couldn't show that the representation was below standard. Certainly, he can at some point, if he can point to things that counsel, bad strategic decisions that prejudice him, such as withholding important discovery materials that would have made a difference had he known about it and could have presented information to rebut it, that may, as recognized in the Day case and the other cases that the defendant cites, that factually could raise a claim of ineffective assistance.
Well, as I understand it, though, counsel, he's not raising an ineffective assistance claim here. The claim is that because he wasn't allowed to review the discovery, it impugned the relationship he had with the lawyer, causing a complete breakdown, which the trial court failed to recognize.
Right. So, but I think he's phrasing it in terms of, because I had a right to do this, and because I wasn't entitled to that right, in a vacuum, it somehow affected my ability to properly present my defense through my inability to work with counsel and such. He's arguing in a vacuum. And so I think that's why we have to look at it and say he was not entitled to review discovery. He was all himself. He was entitled to an attorney who would properly present his case. Effective representation. Effective representation doesn't necessarily require defense counsel to provide all the discovery documents to the defendant so he can view them personally. And I'm not talking about providing copies. I'm just saying, essentially, he wanted someone to sit with him for who knows how long and review thousands of pages of discovery. I mean, that would be a huge burden on defense counsels if this court were to find that that was somehow required. And that's what he was saying. And so basically, it's the way he has phrased this and said, because I was denied my right to do this particular thing, I wasn't able to work with my counsel, and I don't feel comfortable that they're properly able to present my defense. The trial court considered that, those allegations, and found that situation did not prevent the defense attorneys from properly presenting this case. They said, we've reviewed all the discovery. We've discussed it with him. We've provided summaries with him. He's seen some important pieces, such as the probable cause affidavit, which is, in essence is a summary of all of the evidence, at least up to the point of the arrest warrant. And I don't believe in this case there was much that happened after that, other than Mr. Gundelson's statement, which then was also provided to him. And so he's trying to argue this in a vacuum by saying, because I was just generally denied this right, I don't have attorneys that can help me. And I don't think that's sufficient. The court found that wasn't sufficient. I think we also have the same type of argument with regard to their right to testify at the suppression hearing. He was claiming that he wanted to testify at the suppression hearing, and the trial court and his attorneys wouldn't let him. Clearly, that was a strategic decision that the attorneys were entitled to make. It's a strategic decision to whether to file a motion in the first place. And that was recognized in the Hemingway case. If the strategic decision to file a motion, if it's a strategic decision to file a motion, then it must follow that it's a strategic decision to decide what witnesses to call, including the defendant. There's no case law that recognizes the defendant's right to testify at a preliminary motions hearing. You don't have a right to testify at the grand jury proceedings. That's a factual issue. You don't have a right to testify at a prelim or even call witnesses at a preliminary hearing, a constitutional right. And so there's, as the courts have recognized, there are preliminary proceedings don't involve the issue necessarily of ultimate guilt or innocence, that the defendant is just simply not entitled to, as a matter of constitutional law, to testify at. And certainly, Colorado has no state statute, unlike Washington, and I believe there are others, that provide for a hearing. Rule 41 allows for a suppression hearing. There's nothing in the language of Rule 41 that specifically says the defendant either has to be allowed to testify, has to be, or even indirectly, like in Washington, has to be told of his right to testify. There's nothing that suggests that in Colorado statute. So absent that, the trial court was faced with a defendant who was claiming, basically, I want a new attorney because I disagree with my counsel's strategic decisions. And the case law is clear that that doesn't constitute an irreconcilable breakdown. And that's all he's claiming the basis for that. So in the absence of what Bergeron talks about is an impermissible choice between the right to counsel and the right to important trial rights, there just was no such impermissible choice here. The defendant chose to go pro se. He was undisputedly adequately advised pursuant to Arguello regarding the concerns about going pro se, and he chose several times following that advisement to continue to proceed pro se. And I think that that was not an impermissible choice to make him. I'd be happy to discuss any of the other issues. I believe I've fully addressed all of the issues in my answer brief. I'd be happy to answer any other questions with regard to this issue or any of the others. But if there's no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm. Thank you.
I just have three very quick points I wanted to make in reply to the people's argument. First of all, regarding the amount of time or the expense that would be associated with having a law clerk or a paralegal or some clerical staff go out and sit there while a defendant looks at discovery, many attorneys in private practice do that all the time. I mean, I have done that, sending somebody out with discovery to look at the discovery when I'm not there. It's done. And unless there's a different standard for the public defenders, it should be applied. It should be expected that they could do the same thing that attorneys in private practice do. The other thing I wanted to mention was with regard to the issue of whether this was a trial right that was impaired by failing to show or failing to let the defendant see the discovery pretrial. What occurred to me is that when a court does a Curtis advisement, amongst other things, the court asks the defendant, are you satisfied with the representation you've had? Do you need more time to think about your decision, whether you're going to testify or not? If a defendant hasn't seen the discovery before trial, imagine the fiasco that would result if the defendant were to tell the judge in the middle of the Curtis advisement, I'd like to look at all the discovery before I make my decision. I mean, this is why it's important that a defendant be allowed to see the discovery before trial. And we time us up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.